This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
When you conceive of the poem as a linear object, and if you conceive it as an organism, then if you think of the body of, well, if you think of your own body, it cannot be said to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's a whole thing. And so, and a poem in the same way doesn't have to have a beginning, middle, and an end. It's an object. Perhaps it has an undiscoverable center from which it radiates and to which it returns, but it doesn't have a beginning.
It is a picture of the universe. If the universe is the right here, right now, and you and what you are is the point of the universe's consciousness, then there is no conceivable philosophical proposition of middle, beginning, and end. It's an invention. It's an invention that happens within this and can be a picture, but wholly within it. But if the universe is created by a God in the beginning and suffers, goes through suffering and travail and a drama, and then has its last day, then you very clearly have why men were involved with, and rightly, with middle, beginning, and end. And since we all have very different, certainly one thing that comes into evidence when you see a large group of poems is that quite clearly men have now a variety of pictures about how the universe, what the universe is, what the big area of their existence is, and that can be almost include that the world is flat. In a curious way, by this business of the now only existing can actually then provide for having a flat world. It was a stubborn thing to say the world is really only as I see it. Walk around the
thing. Excuse me.
No, I was thinking about what a
I think Alan has something of the character when a music enters it, and a good deal of preaching, and sees Crane as preaching. That's why he said that the peril was to preach wrong. Yeah, the peril of the poem was to say a wrong thing, to give a wrong message. Yeah. Right. But I meant the point of the
peril. The point then equally seems, because I was actually thinking the same thing, that in each case, what is there provides for this nature, for this individuation of natures, and yet provides for the feeling to return, to be there distinctly for each one of us. In other words, there is no structure of any order that I've ever been aware of that always gives the same answer. I mean, that to each person who goes to it.
Listen, let's try. Shut up, Bill. let's try. I was noticing the same thing. There's a kind of information that all our talking doesn't make that. As Anton is another thing, we really do reveal ourselves. Through the medium, I was thinking of taking that later, the later Williams, the poems that are desert music, and to get to Williams, and if each of the four of us could read one poem from the desert music Journey to Love group, and also select the one that seems to us to be, even if we repeat the one someone else has read, the one that you feel really has been on, that we, in hearing the way it's read, because we all derive, all four of us have derived from Williams. Very definitely. You'd see, you would see right away by the way we read it. After all, we had to look at that page and decide what it was. And in that decision, we certainly made four different choices.
Let's do that.
The ivy crown. The whole process is a lie, unless, crowned by excess, it break forcefully one way or another from its confinement, or find a deeper well. Antony and Cleopatra were right. They have shown the way. I love you or I do not live at all. Daffodil time is past. This is summer, summer, the heart says, and not even the full of it. No doubts are permitted, though they will come and may, before our time, overwhelm us. We are only mortal, but being mortal can defy our fate. We may, by an outside chance, even win. We do not look to see jonquils and violets come again, but there are still the roses. Romance has no part in it. The business of love is cruelty, which, by our will, we transform to live together. It has its seasons, for and against, whatever the heart fumbles in the dark to assert toward the end of May. Just as the nature of briars is to tear flesh, I have proceeded through them. Keep the briars out, they say. You cannot live and keep free of briars. Children pick flowers. Let them. Though having them in hand, they have no further use for them, but leave them crumpled at the curb's edge. At our age, the imagination across the sorry facts lifts us to make roses stand before thorns. Sure, love is cruel and selfish and totally obtuse, at least blinded by the light young love is. But we are older, I to love and you to be loved. We have, no matter how, by our will, survived to keep the jeweled prize always at our fingertips. We will it so, and so it is, past all accident.
Tribute to the painters. Satyrs dance, all the deformities take wing, centaurs leading to the rout of the vocables and the writings of Gertrude Stein. But you cannot be an artist by mere ineptitude. The dream is in pursuit. The neat figures of tribute to the painters. Satyrs dance, all the deformities take wing, centaurs leading to the rout of the vocables in the writings of Gertrude Stein. But you cannot be an artist by mere ineptitude. The dream is in pursuit. The neat figures of Paul Klee fill the canvas, but that is not the work of a child. The cure began, perhaps, with the abstractions of Arabic art. Dürer, with his melancholy, was aware of it, the shattered masonry. Leonardo saw it, the obsession, and ridiculed it in La Gioconda. Bosch's congeries of tortured souls and devils who prey on them, fish swallowing their own entrails. Freud, Picasso, Juan Gris, the letter from a friend saying, "For the last 3 nights I have slept like a baby without liquor or dope of any sort." We know that a stasis from a chrysalis has stretched its wings like a bull or the Minotaur or Beethoven in the scherzo of his Ninth Symphony stomped his heavy feet. I saw love mounted naked on a horse, on a swan, the back of a fish, the bloodthirsty conger eel, and laughed, recalling the Jew in the pit among his fellows when the indifferent chap with the machine gun was spraying the heap. He had not yet been hit, but smiled, comforting his companions. Dreams possess me, and the dance of my thoughts involving animals, the blameless beasts. And there came to me just now the knowledge of the tyranny of the image and how men in their designs have learned to shatter it, whatever it may be, that the trouble in their minds shall be quieted, put to bed again.
Yes.
In the back here. He's in the sanctuary. Or does the music section.
Oh.
Some of those are not.
What you do with the fourth volume?
Yeah, they know.
Where are you, Paul?
That's in there.
There's, yeah. To Daphne in Virginia. The smell of the heat is boxwood. When arousing us, a movement of the air stirs our thoughts that had no life in them to a life in which two women agonize. To live and to breathe is no less. Two young women. The box odor is the odor of that of which, partaking separately, each to herself, I partake also. Separately. Be patient that I address you in a poem. There is no other fit medium. The mind lives there. It is uncertain, can trick us and leave us agonized. But for resources, what can equal it? There is nothing. We should be lost without its wings to fly up upon. The mind is the cause of our distresses, but of it we can build anew. Oh, something more than its flies off to a woman's world of cross-fixed, stopping thought. A new world is only a new mind, and the mind and the poem are all a piece. Two young women to be snared, odor of box, to bind and hold them for the mind's labor. All women are fated similarly, facing men, and there is also another such as I who loves them, loves all women, but finds himself touching them like other men, often confused. I have two sons, the husbands of these women, who live also in a world of love apart. Shall this odor of box in the heat not also touch them, fronting a world of women from which they are debarred by the very sense which draw them on against easy access? In our family we stammer unless half mad, we come to speech at last. And I am not a young man. My love encumbers me. It is a love less than a young man's love, but like this box odor, more penetrant, infinitely more penetrant. In that sense, not to be resisted. There is in the heart give and take of a man's life with a woman, a thing which is not the stress itself, but beyond and above that, something that wants to rise and shake itself, free. We are not chickadees on a bare limb with a worm in the mouth. The worm is in our brains and concerns them, and not food for our offspring, wants to disrupt our thought and throw it to the newspapers or anywhere. There is, in short, a counter-stress born of the sexual shock which survives it, confident with the moon to keep its own mind. There is, of course, more. Women are not alone in that. At least, while this healing odor is abroad, one can write a poem. Staying here in the country on an old farm, we eat our breakfast on a balcony under an elm. The shrubs below us are neglected, and there, penned in, or you would eat the garden, lives a pet goose who tilts his head sidewinder, and looked up at him. A very quiet old fellow who writes no poems. Fine mornings we sit there while birds come and go. A pair of robins is building a nest. For the second time this season, men, against their reason, speak of love sometimes when they are old. It is all they can do. Or watch a heavy goose who waddles, flopping noisily in the mud of the pool.
That's to Bill and something, Monahan.
That's right. That's near that.
The next one
after that. I want to open the book like that. That's another volume.
Toward the back, I think. The Dylan show.
After that.
The Dylan Elmer Monahan.
Mother of God, Our Lady, the heart is an unruly matter. Forgive us our sins, as we forgive those who have sinned against us. We submit ourselves to your will, as the flowers and men submit themselves to your holy will. Again, that impossible springtime when men shall be the flowers spread at your feet. As far as spring is from winter, so are we from you now. We have not easily come to our sphere and mirror, but painfully approached sands that have scored our feet. That which we have suffered was for us to suffer. Now, in the winter of the year, the birds who know how to escape suffering by flight are gone. Man alone is that creature who cannot escape suffering by flight. I do not come to you, save that I confess to being half man and half woman. I have seen the ivy cling to a heap of crumbled wall so that you cannot tell by which either stands. This is to say, the she to whom I cling is losing both of us so well. Mother of God, I have seen you stoop to a mere flower and raven and pressed it to your cheek. I could have called out joyfully, but you were too far off. You are a woman, and it was a woman's difficulty. You have no lovers now in the bare sky, raining flowers. She whispered to you under her head, "Howbeit, you are young and fit to be loved." I declare it boldly, with my heart in my feet and my knees knocking together. Yet I declare, and by God's word, it is no lie, make us humble and obedient to the Lord. There are men who, as they live, fling caution to the wind and women play them and love them for them, cruel as the blood of the cat. The moon, which they have vulgarized recently, is still your sight, as it was Diana's before you. What do they think they will attain by their ship? But death has not already killed them. Their ship should be directed inward upon us. But I am an old man. I promise. The female principle of the world is my field in the extremity to which I have come. O honey, O fear, O friendship, O
let's be generous. Well, there are the two sides.
I wish it was more of a secular line.
You mean you are
pictures from Bruegel. Pictures from Bruegel. That poem, I think it's for Bill and Eleanor Monahan, I think. This is a beautiful book.
Although he's right, because she is the same moon goddess. I mean, yes. That he's putting it into the to the Mary of Assisi, who is the moon goddess as far and Diana now is pretty much a shadow of her. Even when you read of witch cult, Diana has become by that time a shadow of the Mary of Assisi, who's the major who's the major seed goddess at the present time. Do you think it's a Jewish thing about the Mary, or what is it?
Yeah, Venus is.
I mean, he doesn't do it naturally.
It's
just
very practical. I've heard some Catholic
No, but that's actually Williams is Mary is power. Also, she's Virgo like Diana. And the Virgo with the new moon under her feet is exactly the goddess who also governs because of the moon movement of the water. I don't think they were sailors. The one of the sailors were crazy when fishermen. There is no other today.
Who will believe in you?
I think Mary is the present goddess. Still present. No, but there is no other in our Western world. Although there are the others, Diana and Ishtar, are still there, but because of the power of Mary, they tend to become shadows.
Can you just come back to the turtle for my grandson? Not because of his eyes, the eyes of a bird, but because his beak, bird-like, to do an injury, has the turtle attracted you. He is your only pet. When we are together, you talk of nothing else, ascribing all sorts of murderous motives to his least action. You ask me to write a poem, should I have poems to write, about a turtle. The turtle lives in the mud, but is not mud-like. You can tell it by his eyes, which are clear. When he shall escape his present confinement, he will stride about the world, destroying all with his sharp beak. Whatever opposes him in the streets of the city shall go down. Cars will be overturned, and upon his back shall ride to his conquest, my lord, you. You shall be master. In the beginning, there was a great tortoise who supported the world. Upon him, all ultimately rests. Without him, nothing will stand. He is all wise and can outrun the hare. In the night, his eyes carry him to unknown places. He is your friend.
He's also in Dr. Doolittle.
I have something of law here, notice.
These are
going to be closed
translations.
Just a little bit of that bit that I read you this morning.
Yeah.
I find it by the picture. Somewhere in here, sorry. I forget what this comes from. Oh, it's prose of Federico Garcia Lorca. The poet who is going to write a poem has the vague sensation of going to a nocturnal hunting party in a wood a long way away. An unaccountable fear whispers in his heart. To calm himself, it is always useful for him to drink a glass of cold water and make black pen strokes with no meaning.
Can you read it in Spanish, too?
I can read it in Spanish, but that's
why. Why don't you read it in English and read it in Spanish?
Well, I'll read a couple lines in Spanish first, maybe it's a challenge in Spanish.
I hate a poem.
It's my thing. Okay. It's very funny, actually, because I am. For El River, the El Bronx. For El River, the El Bronx, los muchachos cantaban enseñando su cultura con la rueda, las fiestas, el cuero y el martillo. 90,000 niñeros acaban la plaza de los rojas y los niños dibujan sus galeras respectivas.
Why can't you make it a little more of that? Yeah, why don't you bring it to Spanish? That's good.
Pero ninguno se dormía. Ninguno quería ser el río. Ninguno amaba las rojas grandes. Ninguno la lengua azul de la playa. Por el estrés y el tímpano. Los muchachos luchaban con la industria. Y los judíos tendían el cono del río, la rosa de la circuncisión, y el cielo desemboca por los puentes y los sacados, manadas de bisontes en bocares puro viento. Pero ninguno se detenía, ninguno quería ser nube, ninguno buscaba los helechos ni la huella canaria del mandarín. Cuando la luna salga, las poleas rodearán para tumbar el cielo. Un límite de agujas cerquerá la memoria, un límite de agujas cerquerá la memoria, y los ataúdes se llevarán a los que no trabajan. Nueve horas de alambres y de muertas. ¿Qué ángel lleva oculto en la mejilla? ¿Qué voz perfecta diga las verdades del frío? ¿Quién el sueño terrible de su enemona manchada? Ni un solo momento, viejo, hermoso Walt Whitman, que dejara de ver su barba llena de mariposa, ni sus hombros de jana gastados por la luna, ni su muslo de Apolo vertinal, ni tu voz como un columna de ceniza, anciano, hermoso, con la niebla, y gemias igual que un pájaro con el sexo atravesado por una aguja, enemigo de Zafiro, enemigo de la vid, y amante de los cuerpos bajas de burda peña. Ni un solo momento que me juro vivir, que en montes de carbón, anuncios y ferrocarriles, soñaba ser un río y dormir como un río, con aquel camarada que pondría en tu pecho un pequeño dolor de ignorancia de la parte. Ni un solo momento, Adán de sangre, macho, hombro solo en el mar, viejo, hermoso, Walt Whitman, porque cuáles azoteas, agrupados en los bares, saliendo en racimos de las alcantarillas, temblando ante las piernas de los chofores, fulgurando en las plataformas de ajeno, los maricas Walt Whitman te soñaban.
I think one thing that happens is that when you read in English, your own tendency to use English take over, and it makes it very, very hard for you to go to another rhythm in English. But when you go to this, you get this really is the music. Plus, I can't read Spanish at all, so it's pure pleasure. And the things on records are mostly read by actors or dramatists, not by poets.
Horribly.
The music was beautiful.
Read it in English now, yeah.
Along the East River and the Bronx, youths were singing, naked to the waist, with the wheels, the oil, leather, and hammer. 90,000 miners extracted silver from rocks, and children through stairways and perspective. But nobody would sleep. Nobody wanted to be a river. Nobody cared about the great leaves. None for the blue tongue of the beach. Along the East River and the Queensborough, Jews were fighting with industry, and the Jews were selling the rose of circumcision to the form of the river. And the sky through the bridges and roofs poured herds of bison driven by the wind. But nobody was poor. None wanted to be a cloud. No one would seek ferns, nor the yellow hoof of the tambourine. At moonrise, pulleys will turn and thus tumble down the sky. A boundary of needles will circle all memory, and coffins will carry away those who don't want to live. New York of slime, New York of wires and death, what angels do you carry hidden in your cheek? What faultless voice will speak the truth of the weak, fool the terrible dreams of your fame and eminence? Not for one moment, beautiful, aged wolf rhythm, have I failed to see your beard full of butterflies, nor your corduroy shoulder worn by the moon, nor your thighs a virginal Apollo, nor your voice like a pillar of ashes, ancient and beautiful as the mist. You moan like a bird with a set transpierced by a needle, enemy of the Savior, enemy of the line, and lover of bodies under rough floor. Not for one moment, manly duty, full of mountains of coal, posters, and railroads, dream of being a river, and sleeping like a river, with that comrade who would put in your breast his small pain of an ignorant leper. Not for one moment, atom of blood, male, lone man in the sea, beautiful, aged Walt Whitman, because in terraces, crowding in bars, pouring out of the sewers in bunches, trembling between the legs of chauffeurs, revolving on platforms of absence, the pansies Walt Whitman dreamed of you. This one also, and this one, and they plunge on your chaste and resplendent beard, northern blonde, negroes in the sand, shouting and gesticulating multitudes like cats or snakes, the pansies Walt Whitman, the pansies disordered with tears, flesh for the whip, boot or bite of subduers. This one also, this one. Stained fingers point to the edge of your dream, while the friend eats your apple, tasting faintly of petrol, and the sun sings around the navels of boys playing under the bridges. But you were not seeking scratched eyes, or pitch dark swamps where children are submerged, or frozen saliva, or the curved wounds like closed bellies, which fairies carry in cars and terraces, while the moon looks at them in the corners of fear. You were looking for a nakedness like a river, bull and dream that would join the wheels of the seaweed, father of your agony, camellia of your death, who would moan in the flame of your hidden equator. Because it is just that man seeks not to delight in the jungle of blood of the following morning. Heaven has shores where life can be avoided, and certain bodies should not be repeated as long. Agony, agony, dream, ferment, and dream. This is the world, my friend. Agony, agony. Corpses are decomposing under the block of cities. War passes through the millions, gray, wrapped in paper. The rich get to their mistresses, small, illuminated mortar guns. And life now is not noble, or good, or sacred. Man can, if he wishes, lead his desire through vein of coral or celestial moon. gallant breeze will turn tomorrow into rock, and time will be a breeze which comes to sleep in the grasses. That is why I do not raise my voice, ages Walt Whitman, against a little boy writing on his pillow a girl's name, nor against the youth who puts on a bride's dress in the darkness of the wardrobe, nor against the solitary men in clubs who drink with nausea the water of prostitution, nor against men being black who love boys and burn their lips in fire, but against youth, against fairies of the city with swollen flesh and unclean minds, dregs of mud, harpies, sleepless enemies of the love that gives away garlands of joy. Against you only, you who with bitter poison give you to drop the soil of death, against you always, fairies of North America, pajaros de Serrano, potos of Mexico, sarasas of Cadiz, apios of Seville, cantos of Madrid, loras of Alicante, Adelaides of Portugal, handlies of the world, murderers of doves, women slain, bitches in their boudoirs, bred in public squares in the fever of a fan, or ambushed in frigid landscapes of hemlock. Let there be no quarter. Death flows from your eyes and heaps gray flowers on the shores of this line. Let there be no quarter. Look out. Let the perplexed, the pure, the traditional, the novice, the supplicant, close the doors of the Bacchanal. And you, beautiful Walt Whitman, sleep on the banks of the Hudson with your beard towards the pole and your hands open, bland clay or snow, your tongue called out for comrades. Keep watch on your gazelles without a body. Sleep. Nothing remains. A dance of walls agitates the meadow. And America drowns herself in a flood of machines and lament. I want the strong wind of the deepest night to remove flowers and words from the vault where you lie asleep. And a black boy announcing to the gold-minded white the arrival of the reign of the ear of corn. What a prophecy it worked out.
There is a little life. Thinking of the other groups, because I was recalling the poet's inability to see poets. Somebody had what you think would be the most bright idea conceivable. They actually arranged, Lorca was in New York. He didn't speak English, and he hated the American language. And he talked everywhere in Columbia about the fact that America since Whitman had no poets at all. He was in New York in 1928. He did. They read the poems to each other and both thought the other was a page. They were brought together in the neat, and I'm not sure about Hart Crane, but I did trace it down Lorca. Lorca was so convinced there were no poets, and he heard Hart Crane and said, yes, there are no poets at all here. And they stared at each other and went off home. Hart Crane, he didn't have a program that there were no Spanish poets, but Lorca soon was in South America saying there were no poets at all in America, that it had destroyed. Well, think of New York then. Williams was working in New York, Marion Moore was in New York. It was a firm, and here you had one of those confrontations. You would swear through this poem that what could be closer to the bridge and the whole spirit of the bridge than the Walt Whitman poem. But even when the poems of Crane were translated beforehand, Rooke had been shown them, because it was a Spanish American who would translate the poems, and then you'll meet the poet and he'll read and you'll really know, and he just looked. And I thought, well, I know poetry. No, they were reading with their voices, I'm afraid. At least, let's risk the whole thing that they were reading with their voices, because this is one of the painful, the shock of recognition of Edmund Wilson called a collection of spirits in poetry and in the poetry that's in the novel, who, when confronted, really just looked.
So I can understand why they're not making it in the morning quarter. Or even if it's... Wilson Crane was very shy. He was awkward when he came in. He got hysterical.
Well, I found the people now saying that some of them were going to the site for 11 minutes.
Oh,
Oh, there is one. Can we have just the time to read this? Sure. The Duende is a thing. It's all in... I really, this is, of course, a lecture, but I know a part I want to find in it of the Duende, so that it, because otherwise it's practically a propositional analysis. And it's really sort of in the beginning. It's right in the opening thing here, I think. Yeah, this is it. This is, and then he goes on and lectures about Duende in Spanish literature. But what, right here, this is a great... There are many, many... by the way, Rilke and Lorca are, I think, the two strong things that enter in the 30s, the whole American poetic world. And they are the complication that lies between the Towns, Williams... generation of immediate masters in the American language, and then came the complication of this German and this Spanish, and I think no French poet really came, although they had a strong surrealist movement, it seemed exclusive of anything understood. Breton, for instance, now I find opening up, but not then. Georgia was brought into the picture and translated, but didn't have that effect. These two did. Artaud, yes. Artaud is what really happened in Black Mountain Review period. Yeah. The force of Artaud is a major force and stronger than any surreal one. For one thing, Artaud's break with surrealism is saying, no, it is not a special little thing that we're going to have a magic cure. It's some deep need, and it's a world need. I will go anywhere, and I'm primitive. I'm not a surrealist, or I'm not a member of an art movement. Well, let me read this, because it was one of the entrances of this demand that the poem has of the dark thing. All through Andalusia, from the rock of Jaén to the shell of Cadiz, people constantly speak of the Duende and recognize it with unfailing instinct when it appears. The wonderful flamenco singer Elejbujano, creator of the Debla, said, "When I sing with Duende, nobody can equal me." The old gypsy dancer La Melena exclaimed once upon hearing Brelowski play Bach, "Ole, if this has Duende," and she was bored by Gluck, Brahms, and Darius Milhaud. And Manuel Torres, a man with more culture in his veins than anybody I've known, when listening to Fire playing his own Nocturno del Generalife, made this splendid pronouncement, "All that has dark sounds has Duende, and there is no greater truth." Now we're in it. Once he said, "All that has dark sounds has Duende," and we ceased the gossip that went on before about whether Brahms had it or didn't. "These dark sounds are the mystery, the roots thrusting into the fertile loam known to all of us, ignored by all of us, but from which we get what is real in art." Torres here agrees with Goethe, who defined the Duende when he attributed to Paganini a mysterious power that everyone feels but that no philosopher has explained. Thus the Duende has a power and is a power and not a behavior. It is a struggle and not a concept. I've heard an old guitarist master say, "The Duende is not in the throat. The Duende surges up in the soles of the feet," which means that it is not a matter of ability, but a real life, live form of blood, of ancient culture, of creative action. This mysterious power that everyone feels but no philosopher has explained is in fact the spirit of the earth. It is the same Duende that gripped the heart of Nietzsche, who had been seeking its external forms on the Rialto Bridge or in the music of Bizet without ever finding it or being aware that the Duende he pursued had jumped from the mysterious Greeks to the dances of Cadiz, or the broken Dionysian cry of Silverius Segui. Well, that's it. I do not want anybody to confuse the Duende with Luther's theological daemon of doubt, at whom with a Bacchic touch he flung an inkpot in Nuremberg, nor with the Catholic daemon, destructive and not very intelligent, who disguises himself as a bitch in order to enter convents. No. The dark and quivering Duende that I am talking about is a descendant of the merry daemon of Socrates, all marble and salt, who angrily scratched his master on the day he drank hemlock. a descendant also of Descartes' melancholy daemon, small as a green almond, who, tired of lines and circles, went out along the canal to hear the drunken sailors sing. Every step that a man, or as Nietzsche would say, an artist, takes toward the tower of his perfection is at the cost of the struggle he maintains with the duende, not with an angel, as has been said, and not with a muse. It is necessary to draw this fundamental distinction in order to arrive at the root of any work. I'm going to read this in which, because it does show how we get caught, and he gets caught here. He wants to say, I will take the duende, I will not take the muse, I will not take the angel. He does see that there are three very separate powers that can be called on. Robert Graves, for instance, says, only the muse is true, the duende is fake, and I will have nothing to do with the angel is something that is just talk. But Charles Olson in 1957 in San Francisco gave a form. It was not only this, but also this, but also this, but also this. Not, I will not this versus that. Mm-hmm. And if we were to read this, as Lawson couldn't, and this is part of what, you see, look, to get the duende to us, to all of us as living human beings, he could only do it in Spain by saying not the muse. And you'll see why, because there was a whole thing in poetry that was shacked up with the muse and kicking the duende in the face. So because we are always composite, we find ourselves then, since we've got to have a duende, we kick the muse in the face. But you have to, because all these other bastards over there got a little plastic statue of her. Everything. Duende's dead, muse is dead, and the angel's dead. But as these, okay, let's go ahead with it then. And in our minds, the fact that if there's a difference, it's that we really will have to do with these three powers, the muse, the angel, and duende, and come to know them. The angel guides and endows with gifts like San Raphael, or defends and wards off like St. Michael, or warns like St. Gabriel. The angel may dazzle, but he merely hovers over the head of man. He bestows his graces, and man quite effortlessly achieves his work, his sympathy, or his dance. The angel on the road to Damascus, and the one who entered through the lattice of the little window at Assisi, or the one who followed the steps of Heinrich Suso, is an angel that commands, and no one can resist his radiance, because he moves his steel wings from the ambit of the elect. The muse dictates and occasionally inspires. There is relatively little she can do, for she is by now distant and so weary. I've seen her twice that I had to strengthen her with half a heart of marble. The muse-inspired poets hear voices without knowing where they come from. You see, since I slightly identified with this side poet, I didn't like these put down. No one does, but he was giving a big put down here. The muse-inspired poets hear voices without knowing where they come from. They come from the muse, who encourages them and sometimes swallows them up. Such was the case of Apollinaire, a great poet destroyed by the horrible muse with whom the magnificent and angelic Rousseau painted him. The muse arouses the intellect and brings colonnaded landscapes and a false taste of law. Very often intellect is poetry's enemy because it is too much given to imitation, because it lifts the poet to a throne of sharp edges and makes him oblivious of the fact that he may suddenly be devoured by ants, or a great arsenic lobster may fall on his head. Against all this, the muses who appear in monocles or among the faintly warm lacquer roses of the little salon are powerless. Angel and muse come from without. The angel gives radiance, the muse gives precepts. Hesiod learned from them. Gold leaf or fold of tunics, the poet receives his norm in his coppice of laurel. On the other hand, the duende has to be aroused in the very cells of the blood. We must repel the angel and kick out the muse and lose our fear of the violet fragrance irradiating from 18th century poetry and of the great telescope in whose lenses sleeps the confining, ailing muse. The real struggle is with the duende. To help us seek the duende, there is neither map nor discipline. All one knows is that it burns the blood like powdered glass, that it exhausts, that it rejects all the sweet geometry one has learned, that it breaks with all styles, that it compels Goya, master of grays, silvers, and those pinks in the best English paintings, to paint with his knees and with his fists horrible but human blacks, or that it leaves Mosin, Cinco, Verdagues, naked in the cold air of the Pyrenees, or that it takes Jorge Manrique to wait for death in the wilderness of Ocaña, or that it addresses the delicate body of Rambo in an acrobat's green suit, or that it puts the eyes of a dead fish in Count Lautréamont in the early morning boulevard. The Duane day seems to be at least, because I'm thinking, would the Furies be a fourth in that line? The Fates. But he has, the Duane day seems to have been in the disappearances of Furies and Fates, take on both. Not a command, but it is not fate as you have to do so and so, but fate as Oedipus tearing his eyes out. I mean, only he knows to do that. And it's one of those, it is like those acts that he describes as a poet.
I know you have it in the blog.
The blog.
Let's stop for now then.